This Slate spoiler special is meant to be played after you see the movie being discussed. The podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, here with a Slate spoiler special podcast on Dope, the new film from writer-director Rick Famuyiwa. And joining me in Slate's New York studio are three co-discussants who are all of the panelists on the Panoply podcast about race. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hey, what up?
By the way, I've never been called a co-discussant
before. Me either.
I was like, is that a new racial slur? What's going on here?
We're going to co-opt that word.
Who are you calling co-discussant?
Yeah. Word. That's a crazy word.
I think
cool
I just
word.
Made that up.
Yeah.
It's a great word.
Co-discussant.
You have that right.
At least I didn't call you co-discussing.
That should replace ally.
I was just going to say that.
Oh, that's great. Okay, good.
So you guys, I'm very excited that you came in for this. I'm a big listener to your podcast, and I hope that, you know, our audiences will cross paths this way, and some of your folks will discover me, and my folks will discover you. So let me introduce you one by one. Okay, to my left is Baratunde Thurston. Hello, Baratunde.
Hello.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for being here.
Raquel Cepeda.
Hello. What's up?
And Tanner Colby.
Hello.
A longtime spoiler partner.
Since 2007?
I don't know. Do you have it engraved?
Damn, Tanner.
Well, Love Guru, was that our first one? Or?
Oh, my God. I can't believe we spoiled that movie together.
Yeah, we did.
That's the movie that essentially you can never recover from the shame of having seen. And we've been through that humiliation together.
Yes.
This is starting to sound very salacious here in this conversation. Should we leave?
What is Love
Should
Baratunde,
guys? Exactly. Should Baratunde
Oh, thank God it sank like a stone. It was that terrible, terrible
Mike Myers movie.
All right, but today we're here to discuss, I think, a pretty good movie. And what I usually do is go around first and just get a quick reaction of, you know, sort of thumbs up, thumbs down. Would you send your friends to this movie or not? Personally, I thought Dope was delightful. It's one of my favorite movies of the summer so far. What about you guys?
I would use a different word to describe Dope. I would say it's dope. For real, I will be upset if my friends don't see it. I love it, so they should do it.
Dope is fresh to death. I loved it. Everybody I know has seen it almost already. I am going to watch it. I may go see it again. I may take my daughter to see it.
I'm actually going to see it again.
How old is your daughter?
She's 18.
I thought it was great. I think it's rare because it's one of the, you know, in this age of like, it's either blockbuster or Oscar bait drama season, and it's just a fun movie. So you can go and it's 90 minutes, 2 hours, whatever, and it's just a great time.
I agree. I do have mild reservations, which we'll get to in the point at some point in the discussion, but I would totally send people to it. So
definitely.
So now is the time when we essentially summarize what happened in the movie, no holds barred.
Okay.
And in this movie, it's actually very useful to do a spoiler special because there are quite a few twists. So we start off in the neighborhood of the Bottoms in Inglewood, California. Our hero, who is played by Shameik Moore, who's a relative newcomer, I think he's done some TV, but this is his first movie, is named Malcolm. And does somebody want to take it from there? What do we learn about Malcolm in the opening voiceover, which is voiced by Forrest Whitaker, one of the movie's executive
producers? Baratunde was late, so he can't do it.
Why are you going to call me out? Baratunde
was on Color People Time.
And not explain that part of the movie, but Tanner had to throw me under the bus.
Yes.
Thank you, white co-discussant.
So Malcolm is a kid in Inglewood. He's obsessed with 90s hip-hop. He and his friends all go and they all talk in 90s hip-hop slang and dress in 90s hip-hop gear. But funnily enough, they have their own band, which is called Oreo, which is really sort of white people pop that they play.
I wouldn't say it was white people pop.
But they're obsessed with white people's stuff. That's part of what the setup is.
Well, they're being accused of liking white people's stuff because they're
like Donald Glover, which was a great joke, by the way.
Oh, yeah. That was really funny. But they like skateboarding, which I think some of that is biographical to Pharrell because he loves, you know, he was called like a white boy because he liked skateboarding when he was younger, and punk music or rock music or hardcore music or whatever, anything that's non-urban. Mm-hmm. So they were being accused of being Oreos. I guess that's the music they play.
If the music that they love is this early 90s hip hop, the music they play is really more like straight down the line punk almost.
Yeah. It was really cool to see that. It really touched me to see that on screen. You know, it was very complex. People that like, you know, that kind of challenge that one note narrative of just liking all things urban. And I just love seeing that and seeing how also that, I don't know the young lady's name who played Malcolm's best friend.
Kiersey Clemons is her name.
She was just like accepted. And when I grew up, everybody had a gay friend that was accepted. It wasn't like a big conversation that we're having. Well, actually, maybe should have been a big conversation back then, but we were just teenagers. So we're just like, yo, that's your gay friend.
Right. Well,
there's
kind of a cute reveal too, where she is essentially presented as a boy for the first scene
or
so, right?
I just absolutely love that. I just love the nuances mm-hmm. and the non-binary approach that they took to making this film.
So that's the key threesome. Let's establish them. We've got Shameik Moore as Malcolm, and then playing with him in his band and essentially sort of accompanying him in his geek posse around high school.
His co-discussants.
Yes.
His co-discussants,
if you will, are Kiersey Clemons as Diggy. And then Tony Revolori, who you might recognize from the Grand Budapest Hotel, as Jib, that's the kid's name, Jib and Diggy.
Jib and Diggy, yeah.
They got the best. My friends didn't have such cool names when I was in high school.
Right.
And we never know what Jib is, right? Do we ever know? Do we ever find out? He's ethnically ambiguous.
He's like 14% African. That's all we know.
Yeah, he's ethnically ambiguous. Yeah.
This is the discussion they have with the white stoner kid later in the movie, right? Where he's trying to figure out, why can he say the N-word and I can't say the N-word? And I love that they left the Tony Revolori character's kind of racial, his ethnic background completely. Yeah, he's Guatemalan in real life, Tony Revolori. But, you know, he could be anything.
So the basic plot, the next step of the plot is that Malcolm, because he's infatuated with this girl that a drug dealer is also infatuated with, he ends up going to the drug dealer's birthday party. There's a shootout. The drugs get shoved in his backpack, and he finds them the next day when he shows up at school, and there's panic. And
plus a gun, don't forget.
Plus a gun. And he gets thrust into this, you know, drug dealing caper plot. And what was great, they talked about this in the New York Times profile of the movie, you know, you had all of these menace to society, Boys in the Hood movies from the early 90s that really sort of defined that era of black cinema. Mm-hmm. And I think it's impossible to overstate how much, if you're a white kid in the suburbs, that defined black America for you. It was Ice Cube and the Drive-Bys and NWA, and that was our image of black America. And what was great, what the director was trying to do with the movie was say, I mean, there's great variety within the black community. You had all these black nerds and different kids who were in the same environment. So it was kind of a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, taking the lens in the Menace to Society world and turning it around and putting it on the other black people and what their life is like in that world to sort of expand it.
Well, and even Dom, who's the corner drug dealer and the gangster and the guy who throws the big party where, you know, this drug exchange happens, is not portrayed as kind of like, you know, just he's not just sort of a gangster with grills.
No,
you know
what's cool?
Very
intelligent.
Yeah,
in the hood,
who debates 90s hip hop with Malcolm.
In the hood, when women are that way, we call them ghetto flowers. So he was like a male version of a ghetto flower, somebody who has a lot of potential. Had he been a white kid, and he would have had great social capital, perhaps, and gone on to do something else, you know, and it kind of, to me, showed that, you know, they're kids, if you just engage them in the hood, that are very smart and can put two and two together. And I just,
and
he was one.
Engage them first.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Exactly. So for me, he was one of my favorite characters. And I have a feeling that we're going to see a lot of A$AP Rocky. He was just a natural.
Yeah, he really
was. Yeah.
But he kind of dropped out of the movie, though. It was sort of too bad that after that one phone call from jail, you never hear from Dom again.
But you know what's interesting? Every character almost was treated the way like a Kurt Vonnegut like character was. Like even if they were like just an extra, everybody had flesh and bone, which I just really respected that with the writer without being so overly preachy or whatever. Or everybody didn't have everybody needed to have a message. But every character had a soul, had flesh, and had bone.
Even, I think there's a little
like
bit.
That.
We haven't gotten there, but I think there is a little preachiness that comes in that last closing monologue.
But it didn't end there. But it didn't end there, which I was like, shh, thank God.
And if you want to just pick the two main driving forces of the film, the first is that Malcolm is trying to get into Harvard. He has an interview scheduled. His public high school guidance counselor does not believe in him and talks him down and down. You're arrogant. He calls him arrogant for thinking that Harvard would waste its time on him. He has a great idea for a college essay, and the counselor says, no, you stay in your lane. You're a poor, fatherless kid from the hood.
Yep.
You write that essay. So that's his drive. He wants to get out. He wants to get to Harvard, and then he gets loaded with hood drugs by the man who was supposed to be the best example of escaping the hood, who has created these little half-baked hood rats in his mansion in the suburbs, runs a check-cashing place, exploiting his own community, and is actually the biggest drug supplier that we can see in this film so far, and the reason this whole thing happened in some weird way.
I mean, to me, that was a weakness in the movie. For one thing, I mean, I guess it's just a movie coincidence, but that this one guy would be the locus of all of those things was kind of – but I'm willing to buy that coincidence if the scenes don't sort of – I don't know. Just don't
I thought
make
it
their
was,
point quite so hard.
I thought it was cool. I thought I wasn't expecting it. It was just one of those things I wasn't expecting. I thought it wasn't really a bad – I think he was saying – making a statement with that.
Well, and I think it the film sort of paused to make a statement. When the shootout happened at A$AP Rocky's party and he ran out with the drugs. And at that point, I thought, this movie's going to be one of those movies that just, it's like, it's a 48-hour nonstop, you know, he's running.
Like Mad Max?
Yeah. Right?
Oh, that's a wrap. That's a wrap.
Or After and Hours, right? Like something right. where you yeah. get
something
caught
like
up in
after
this
hours,
rhythm,
where,
this night
where
you
it just,
can't escape.
Where, yeah, the night you can't escape, but the day you can't escape.
Yeah.
And then it stops, and then we're hanging out at the drug dealer's house for a while, and then we got a job interview, and then it's moving fast again, and then I just felt like the tone, it's a lot of fun, but it's kind of shaggy. I felt like the tone sort of was all over the place.
So you wanted that chase pace to
yeah
yeah I wanted I wanted to keep that going like them like on their bikes you know zooming
but they
around.
They would have
I
had
like
time pausing, to set yeah. up their Bitcoin powered yeah. dark web Molly business online like
right.
that takes a pause.
Right, right.
That
and so that's what
bothers
me. That what
yeah.
dominates the second half of the movie, yeah. Bartender, is exactly that. Right. So then they need to get rid of these drugs. They've discovered like we can't return them. Right. There's no way to return them without us either like getting killed, whatever, getting arrested. So we're just going to sell these drugs online. And they hook up with this white stoner kind of Burning Man type dude played by Blake Anderson, who's going to help them offload the drugs. And like you say, Tanner, things kind of slow down plot wise at this point because they need to take the time to learn how to build a hidden website. And, you know, they throw a party and they through social media start to offload this Molly
on
onto
the dark
population.
I didn't have a problem with the pacing going up and down fast and slow. And I wanted to learn about, I mean, I just found myself really interested. And I mean, you had to slow down if you're going to add the whole tech thing and yeah. angle into it, right? Because like,
no, and
that's like a hard thing to explain, no?
I thought they did a really fun job with like kids going viral.
Yeah.
Like they were very generationally appropriate for if you're going to try to sell drugs on the internet, what would you do? And how would you launch? This is like basically a product launch
yeah.
through a concert, a word of mouth only concert. They, you know, we skipped over my favorite scene of the whole movie, which is, you know, we've left our hero, Lily, the daughter of the millionaire check cashing drug kingpin Harvard man, which when I say it like that, it does sound like a lot character to bear. She feels bad that he's going to miss his Harvard interview. So she drives him on the drive to this interview. She freaks out. She has to go to the bathroom really bad. She has to pee. She makes a stop at the best Starbucks parody I've seen in a film.
$7.
$7.
That is so funny.
It was great. It was like McDowell's and Coming to America, but times
right.
10.
Mm-hmm.
And she just squats right in the bushes outside of $7, takes a piss, and then she blows up on the media because of this. And what's the line? I'm hoping somebody.
Oh, there's the meme, the viral meme that's
the
invented.
Pound cake.
Right. How am I supposed to eat my pound cake?
How am I supposed to eat my pound
that
cake?
That is so
I am dropping that even in this life, like not just in the film, because they got this dude. He was basically the Antoine Dodson, the hide your wife, hide your kids.
Right.
Yeah, that was
of
so funny.
The film.
Yeah.
Who is, you know, the black bystander who says something really clever to get on the news that people on the internet turn into a gif that becomes a meme. And so Lily, the character who was on this particular drug, becomes the name of the drug.
Right.
So they don't even call it Molly anymore.
Yeah,
they call
so
it Lily.
Cool. Yeah.
Giving
right.
rise to another
that's
meme.
So
people on Lily be like,
yes.
Yeah, right?
Which
yeah.
is like, that is so internet. Like you are right. just ready for Reddit. Like,
yeah. The movie is like really, really smart about technology yeah. and the viral web and all of that. And I will say, because you guys know from the About Race podcast, I have to chime in on the treatment of white people in the film.
Oh, do we have to talk about white people? Like
well, no, because we had this.
Is there a musical
back.
Theme that kicks in when Tanner talks about
it? It should be a violin.
As we discussed,
the world's tiniest violin.
When we were discussing Fresh Off the Boat and yeah. Blackish makes better fun of white people than Fresh Off the Boat. Fresh Off the Boat's white people were kind of goofy, and I thought this movie was much better at making fun of white people than
yeah.
Dear White People.
Yeah. Okay.
The white guys in this were really, really good. Spot on satires, like mm-hmm. you said, of that Burning Man guy. I was like, why can't I use the N-word? And
yeah, I thought a few times this is the movie that Dear White People wanted
to be. That's exactly what
be.
I said.
Mm, yep.
And get out of my brain.
So I had a similar thought in that I like this one more. And I'm
yeah, I like this one more.
Disclaimer, I have a cameo in Dear White People.
Yeah. You always have to drop that in.
I will, because I have to
separate
myself.
It's relevant
myself.
Here. It's full disclosure.
That and the Harvard degree have
because
to come into every
basically
conversation.
I'm in both these movies. I'm basically in both these movies.
Well, because unlike Dear White People, we won't get off on a discussion yeah. of that movie, but it didn't really have a main character and a main story, right? I mean, this movie feels like it has more of a heart to me. It's not so episodic and spread out and kind yeah. of an excuse for a lot of punchlines and scenarios. It's more like you're following this kid and you care about this kid.
And I think it was yeah. what I liked about it is that it was not binary. So where Dear White People was just dealt with like white and blacks, every in Dope, we were dealing with everybody. and even racial ambiguity.
Right.
I thought that was really cool. Really funny.
Right.
To me, Dear White People...
They're both good movies, yeah. But I like this one better.
And this is more fun, for
this
sure.
This is fun.
Like, Dear White People is like... It is a hard-nosed, a harder nose, like pointed, darker satire. This was a great comedy that... Mm-hmm. And it's younger. It's more playful. It's like high school versus college.
Yeah.
It's an elite liberal multi-generational
versus
a public school.
Yeah.
Multi-generational. Like, Dear White People is all college-age kids only, except for the dean and the school president. We should come back to this movie. I'm so sorry.
So let's get to spoiling, like, the ending, the stuff that happens in the last reel of the movie.
I took a bathroom break. I didn't see what happened at the end.
You just do middles, right?
I'm the king of the middle. I'm like middle. I take the Silicon Valley approach, but middle out is how I watch films as well.
Getting back to Dope.
Yeah.
Dope.
So bring us home. We got kids on Lily. We have Malcolm, who has to go through a series of hoops to not only get the store set up and start distributing, but then convert the Bitcoin that he's generated into cash.
You're right. I was trying to figure out what I would consider to be the action climax of the movie, and it is essentially that moment that he has to trade in this Bitcoin money that he's made on the web, right? This kind of like abstract money for an actual suitcase, a sort of like faux Louis Vuitton or something suitcase full of cash.
You know what? This movie, when I think about it now, reminds me of Pulp Fiction. You're taken on this journey, a very physical journey through the city, and you meet interesting and weird characters along the way. Mm-hmm. You meet a Bitcoin expert. You meet a check cashing Harvard grad who's a drug kingpin. You meet Dom, who's fascinating himself. You meet the pound cake dude, you know, just for a brief flash moment. And you meet the guy with the bags, the fake versus real, another racially undefined character who is somehow key to like the underworld of black market Bitcoin transfers and who demands that Malcolm show who he really is and hit him straight up in the face. So that was a really important beat moment to think about. We're being taken on a tour of characters in a weird world of L.A. that's very multiracial, powers distributed in unexpected ways. It's fun.
Well, I thought it was going to end on that message where, you know, not fitting in is the best place to be. And I was just like, oh, okay. But it didn't end there. It actually ended the way that I love. My favorite endings are open endings. Like, you just don't know. He got this letter. We don't know his letter about whether he got into Harvard or not, right? It's thin. So you really don't know if he got in. Because usually when the letter's thin, I'm told, that means you didn't get into college.
But when it's a big envelope, it usually means...
But it was so thin, no? Oh, okay, for me. Yeah. For somebody like me who... I didn't go to Harvard.
Again, I signed something. I've already said too much.
I didn't know whether he got in or not. I just thought that it was just like an open ending. Like, wow, like this is a point.
I thought he got in because
he gave a little smile to the camera.
He gave a smile when he opened it.
I was pretty certain he got in too, but that's, again, proprietary information. I think we skipped a beat. I'm sorry, on the cash.
Right.
Before we get to the message, the way he ties the knot around his interviewer and drug supplier.
Was brilliant. It was great.
Cool. So you know, he had this challenge of how do I link this Bitcoin account to a real bank account without implicating myself? And so he ends up tying it to the bank account of the check cashing king / drug dealer / Harvard interviewer man. And he delivers a speech back to him. You know, this guy had lectured him about Amazon. He went on a real weird tangent about I want cash instead of drugs. Mm-hmm. But he was like very insistent and plotting when he did that. And Malcolm just delivers such a great closing punch, which is like, your hands are tied. Like,
he basically blackmails him into getting his Harvard recommendation.
Yeah, exactly.
But is the idea, and this is a pretty major plot point for me not to have grasped, but is the idea that he's rigged it in such a way that the guy's going to get caught, or he's not sure if he's going to get caught?
No, that he has a chance of getting caught. Because the government's not looking at all this stuff anyway, but he has coded it.
It's like a carrot that's just dangling there.
It's like a ticking bomb.
Yeah.
I thought it was more that I could pull this trigger at any time. Like, I could reveal this, like if I change
with
one
stroke at the keyboard.
With a stroke at the keyboard.
It's like an IED that he controls.
But that was another weird thing to me, too, was they had the cop, the white cop, who was, like, you know, sort of lurking around the edges. He's looking at a line of code at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
I think that he does get caught.
I think it's implied that
they were, like, doing some encoding.
And I wanted a screenshot of that to see what they were looking at and even how they got to see the programming behind
Yeah, like that I didn't get.
A police officer would not be able to just see the code. It's not. It wasn't.
They
like
probably hired a nerd. They probably hired a right. They probably hired somebody. Like a lot of times, like hackers, right, get hired by the government.
Oh yeah, like in House of Cards. Good.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
So then we forget. There's
back to dope.
There's some loose ends and some shagginess in this movie. As
no,
fun
I
as
like.
It is.
Yeah, no, like I think they're open endings. I think it's just like certain things are meant to be open, like meant for us to interpret.
So what happens in the very end?
Well, there's a second action climax too, right? There's the Asian dude that makes him choose between the two bags, which is the real bag, which is the fake bag, which becomes this whole sort of metaphor for authenticity, right?
Right.
And he ends up with the bag, but then he gets shanghaied by the bullies from his school. Remember the guys who stole his sneakers early on, and they discover, oh my god, he's got this bag full of cash.
And
that's the moment. Yeah, that's the moment that, which is kind of a surprise to us, because so far there's been gun violence, but not Jib, Diggy, and Malcolm have not pulled guns on anybody, right?
Yeah,
they've remained like nerds the whole time, right?
Yeah.
Just solid, like they're trying to keep out of trouble. And suddenly he pulls a gun on the bullies to get his cash back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I loved that moment because it brought it way down from the comedy, right? This was like survival. And he had to make a choice that he never would have voluntarily chosen. He was backed into a corner and he chose survival. Mm-hmm. And so you get the judgment that maybe even he had of the drug dealers that are, you know, poisoning his neighborhood. He got a little experiential glimpse at what they might be going through, just a little bit. And he's on such a different path. He's on the Harvard path, but he has a bag of money and he's defending that bag of money and his future at Harvard with a weapon.
Right.
And I think for the audience, it was a nice, you know, mood change. But for him, there's some calculation. He doesn't want to do this, but he wants to live.
Yeah, and the
and
fact
he chooses
that
his life, you know, over the life of somebody else potentially, and that's a huge decision for anybody, especially a high school kid who has designs on Harvard and geek stuff and punk rock bands and hasn't lived that life at all.
Mm.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was going to say that's the moment that makes him able to write the college application essay that we hear in the very next scene, right, where he's dropped his original idea about Ice Cube's Good Day being his college application essay. And he does write about his background and being from the hood, but he also writes about, I mean, essentially he creates these two portraits, right? Mm-hmm. Like, here's one kid, and he sort of paints a portrait of the kid he was before all this stuff went down. And then imagine this other kid, you know, who's on the run with drugs and a gun and, you know, gang violence. And he sort of, what his essay ends up being about is like this bright line that you're trying to draw between these two kinds of young black men can't really be drawn.
That we are capable of being all of those. And something we talk about so much in our show about race, pluggity plug plug, is that multiple identity life, whether it's the code switching required when you have that kind of life, or whether it's the full spectrum of your humanity and your identity being recognized and how many boxes you check on a census form. His essay was, I check both these boxes. I love to have a friend, actually he's talked about it publicly, so I can even say his name, Ron J. Williams, from Brooklyn, black, went to Harvard, has startup life, and when he talks to high school kids, he presents them with this checklist at the beginning of his talk, and he's like, I want to tell you a couple potential facts about me. One check mark, was arrested for gun possession. One check mark, graduated from Harvard University. One check mark, freestyle rap for 6 years. And they're like, there's no way you went to Harvard. Like these kids, they'll believe the gun. They'll believe the freestyle rap. They do not believe the Harvard thing. They certainly don't believe one person can contain all those worlds. Malcolm's character reminded me of you, Raquel, but he reminds me of my friend Ron much more in that sense because he could check that box, yeah.
Yeah, I think that really is – that's to me the strength of this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, for all the quibbles I may have about the pacing or, you know, was this scene a little bit too heavy? I thought maybe the actual voiceover of the college application essay was a little heavy-handed because we've seen that in Risky Business. We just saw it in The Spectacular Now a couple years ago. Like every time there's a high school senior in a movie, you have to hear him voicing over his college application essay.
Right.
But those things are quibbles just compared to like the spirit and the life this movie has and the breadth of vision that it kind of gives of this kid and his world.
And I like showing kids that are quote-unquote urban – liking things that are not expected of them. Because that kind of, like, when I said that, it reminded me of my husband. He was into hardcore. So when hip-hop was happening, CBGBs was happening in the 80s. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, all these things were, like, going down at the same time. And there were a lot of people who skateboarded and loved to write graffiti. So to me, that was just really cool. That was what had me actually feeling nostalgic a little bit when I was watching it.
You got to take him to see it then.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, y'all. I wish we could talk all day about this movie. I hope you'll come in and spoil another movie with me sometime because it's really fun.
Yes.
So again, Baratunde Thurston, Raquel Cepeda, and Tanner Colby from the About Race podcast on Panoply. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our producer is Zach Dinerstein. The managing producer of Slate Podcasts is Joel Meyer. And the executive producer of Slate Podcasts is Andy Bowers. For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.